The Leslie Marshall Show, a true democracy in talk radio. Of, for, and by you, the people.
Live from our nation's capital, it's Deadline DC with Brad Bannon.
Welcome to Deadline DC with Brad Bannon. I'm Brad Bannon, and you have heard me before as a guest and a guest host on the Leslie Marshall Show. I want to thank Leslie and her executive producer, Mark Grimaldi, for giving me the opportunity to bring Deadline DC to the air. If you don't know me, I'm a pollster and strategist and the CEO of Bannon Communications Research. Bannon Communication polls for and designs research-based research and media and message strategies for progressive issue groups, labor unions, and Democratic candidates. My company is the sponsor of today's show. If you want to learn more about me or my political polling and consulting company, please check out my website at www.bannoncr.com. That's BANNONCR.com. I write a column occasionally for The Hill. I'm on the National Journal's board of political insiders, and I'm a political analyst for WGN TV and radio in Chicago. Today we have two guests. In the first half of the hour, Amy Parnas of The Hill joins us to discuss the Democratic presidential campaign. And in the second half hour, Craig Holman of Public Citizen comes on to talk about ethics and government, which is an oxymoron to most Americans. The Democratic race is in the middle of a shakedown, with Bernie Sanders back, Beto in the race, and Biden waiting in the wings. In the first half hour today, Amy Parnas of The Hill joins us to discuss the Democratic presidential campaign. Amy is the national political correspondent for The Hill and co-author with John Allen of Shattered, the New York Times best-selling book on the 2016 presidential election. She's hard at work already about a book on the 2020 election. Hi, Amy. How are you doing today?
Hi, Brad. I'm great. Thank you for having me on.
Always a pleasure to talk to you. Okay, let's start with the big news. Friday, Beto O'Rourke decided to get in the race. He's already shaken it up. He reported today that he had raised more than $6 million in the first 24 hours of his young candidacy. And he's already taking a lot of flack from some of the progressive elements in the party, including supporters of Bernie Sanders. What do you make of O'Rourke's potential in this race?
Well, you know, for months, that's been the big question, the Beto O'Rourke factor, how he would factor into the 2020 race. And, you know, so far, I think it's been a bit of a mixed bag. Certainly, you can't, his fundraising numbers are nothing to sneeze at. Everyone that I've spoken to today is saying that's a tremendous number, very impressive. Of course, they expected that because of the numbers he was able to pull in his Senate race with Ted Cruz, against Ted Cruz. But I think, you know, he has run into some problems. He stumbled a bit. The Vanity Fair cover was a bit awkward, saying that he was born for this job, and then he made a couple of gaffes where he talked about his wife and how he sometimes is able to help her out, and that was of course a little quip that kind of backfired, and he had to go back and explain it. And then of course you have the fact that a lot of people don't know what he stands for, that the substance is kind of missing from his campaign, and they're wondering if he's a bit of a lightweight, even though a lot of people compare him to former President Barack Obama. So I think a lot remains to be seen about what he can do in this race.
Okay. Let me try this out on you, Amy. Okay. My theory is that someone, I think almost everybody thinks, or most anybody thinks, that the two front runners are Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden. What do you think the chances are that one of the other candidates is going to break through the Biden-Bernie block and become a major player to win the Democratic presidential nomination?
That is a very good question, Brad. I stopped predicting things in 2016, probably on election night, for good reason.
Yeah.
But I think that a couple of people probably stand a good chance of entering maybe the top two or three. I would look at someone like Kamala Harris, who did pretty well during the first couple of weeks of her campaign, got off to a really good start, and a lot of people take her candidacy very seriously. But I do think that we're kind of seeing the top five kind of come into focus. I think Biden will definitely be up there, Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Beto O'Rourke, and I think Kamala Harris. I can't say a lot about the other candidates so far because I don't think people like Kirsten Gillibrand or Cory Booker have had moments. So moments to kind of shine, and they still remain pretty low in the polls, I think, down at 1%. So I don't know if they stand a good chance as of right now.
Okay. Let's try this. There's a lot of concern among some Democrats, especially in Washington, that the party is drifting too far to the left. They talk about, Bernie Sanders, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Do you think that the Democratic Party or the Democratic nominee is going to have problems further on down the line, let's say in the fall of next year, trying to regain the center after a primary campaign that seems to be dominated by very progressive elements within the Democratic Party?
That is the biggest question right now, and that's why a lot of people are sort of leaning on someone like Joe Biden, because they're saying, okay, he is probably one of the few who could win in a general election. And his biggest problem is I don't know if he can make his way out of a primary. So I think that is going to be a big question for any of these candidates right now. How do they kind of capture the excitement that's on the left of at the left of the party right now, and it certainly is, and then how do they sort of move to the center? And it's something that I've been paying attention to for a long time. I've been kind of focused on 2020 now for a couple of years, and I just think it will be interesting to see how a lot of these candidates fare in that. And there are a lot of people who are saying, I could never support someone like Elizabeth Warren, a lot of independents and maybe moderate Republicans. So, it's all dependent on where people are, who they want to capture. But I think that that's going to be a big problem for any of these candidates, how they're going to sort of appeal to independents and moderate Republicans, and how they even, there are a lot of Democrats who feel like they're more centrist and don't want to support someone like Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren. So the party right now is, and I know a lot of people have said, oh no, it's not really in a civil war, but you're kind of watching these various factions kind of go up against each other, and you see what's happening right now with a candidate like Beto O'Rourke and how people are, rallying around him, and how he sort of, Bernie Sanders sent out an email to his supporters today essentially saying, look, he outraised us last month. And there is kind of a competitive thing happening right now between more centrist candidates and the more progressive side. So that'll be interesting to see how that also plays out.
Okay. Let's talk about the two front runners for a minute. You covered the 2016. We'll be right back with more of Deadline DC with Brad Bannon after these messages. with more of Deadline DC with Brad Bannon. Our guest in this half hour is Amy Parnas, national political correspondent for The Hill, and the co-author with John Allen of Shattered, the New York Times number one best-selling book on the 2016 presidential election. And by the way, I think I read pretty much all the books on the 2016 election, and I think Amy and John's book is by far the best. Amy, you're welcome. Well, I think it was, and believe me, I did read. I think I read pretty much all of them, but yours is your and John's book was great and my favorite. You're welcome. You watched Bernie Sanders' campaign in 2016. Is there any difference in his approach this time than it was 4 years ago?
Well, he's certainly shaking things up a bit. He brought some new people around him, and I think he is definitely, he feels the momentum in this race. Certainly he did last time as well, but he feels like this is his time to sort of capture and kind of vindicate what happened in 2016. And so I think that's why you're seeing the surge of support behind him. Certainly a lot of people, the conventional wisdom was, well, how can he do this again? Maybe someone like Elizabeth Warren would sort of capture that excitement because she is kind of a newer face around the party. But, you know, he has done exceedingly, you know, he's exceeded expectations, and I think he definitely has a good shot at winning the nomination. So I think everyone is taking him seriously right now, and I think a lot of people who thought that he would go on to beat President Trump now think that he can defeat him this time around.
Okay. Let's talk about Joe Biden. Joe Biden said the other day at the Delaware Democratic Party dinner that he was going to get in the race. So I assume we're going to be seeing some kind of formal statement soon. What kind of challenges do you think Joe Biden faces in fighting for the Democratic presidential nomination?
I think it's going to be really tricky for him because more than anyone, he has pretty much almost more than anyone, I mean, Bernie Sanders included, he is the one guy who has lots of oppo. He's served in the Senate, and so Republicans are ready to pounce with books and books of opposition against him. And you're already seeing it. You know, people have thought for weeks now that he would enter the race, and they're trying to preempt whatever his decision is by, you know, kind of throwing cold water on the fact that the party isn't the same anymore. He's not going to even return to a party that he, you know, left in early 2017, that it's changed, that as we talked about, it has shifted to the left. And he considers himself, I think, while he would say he's a progressive, he's a centrist kind of candidate and kind of old school and doesn't mind working with Republicans. And he has said as much recently that, you know, if working with Republicans is a bad thing, then consider himself guilty of that, because, you know, he comes from that kind of time where things were more collegial, and you would say things on the floor like "my friends," and so I think he doesn't see anything wrong with that. I think he is going to be in for a bit of a surprise, though, because the party has moved. I think people are going to call him on it. They're going to say, "Why are you the best candidate at this moment in time?" And that was something that, by the way, affected Hillary Clinton. You know, people thought that she wasn't the right candidate, while the most experienced candidate maybe, but not the right candidate for the right time. And even she was trying to figure that out last time around, as John and I report in Shattered. So I think the same thing could kind of fall on Joe Biden when he enters the race.
Okay. One of the things I noticed in either for good or bad, I spend a lot of time on social media during your average day. There is tons of social media activity by the Sanders people. There has been tons of Beto activity, even though he just got in the race the other day. And I hardly see any Joe Biden presence on social media. And it strikes me that in this day and age, that's a troublesome sign. And it also makes me think about a story you wrote for The Hill a couple of weeks ago on the difficulty Joe Biden may have raising money. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, it's very interesting because you think about Obama Biden as sort of a unit. They ran together. They obviously work together and respect each other a lot. But these two, they're almost two different teams, if you will. And so a lot of the people who supported President Obama, a lot of his donors, a lot of his grassroots supporters, won't be with former Vice President Biden. They've kind of moved on. They feel like the party needs a younger, fresher face. And so, you know, while people kind of loop them in together, I think former Vice President Biden will have some difficulty kind of, you know, getting that support from donors and fundraisers. And so what he's been doing in recent weeks is calling a lot of these former supporters of the president and probably current as well, and saying and kind of appealing to them and making the case. And a lot of people, a lot of fundraisers and people in that donor community have said as much. They've said, you know, there are Obama people, there are Obama supporters, donors, fundraisers, there are the same for Clinton, there are Schumer fundraisers, but you don't really have a sense of who are the big Biden fundraisers. And he never really had to do that as a senator, for instance. So he never became really well-versed in fundraising and good at it. I think he kind of learned to be while he was vice president and had to do a number of fundraisers, but it's never kind of been his deal. And so I think a lot of people have wondered what he's been doing in recent weeks, and a lot of that is making calls and kind of, you know, crossing his T's and dotting his I's and making sure that he has that fundraising support. Because if he comes out in the second quarter in April and he shows very weak fundraising numbers, that's going to say a lot about his candidacy. And I think they're trying to prevent that from happening as much as possible on Team Biden.
Okay. Anything you can tell our listeners about what they might be looking for in the next couple of weeks in the Democratic race?
Well, I'm curious to see who, you know, there are all these rivalries kind of forming in the Democratic Party, and you're kind of seeing it happen today with Beto and Bernie. And I'm curious to see how Biden entering the race shakes things up, if it does at all. Who he's looking out for? Is he looking at the Bernie Sanders folks? Is he looking at Beto as his biggest rival? And how these two, because I think those three B's, if you will, these B names, they're the ones to watch. And I think they're all kind of testing each other out right now and seeing where they are in terms of fundraising.
Okay. Amy, thanks very much for joining us today. I hope you'll come back and join us on the show again soon. There sure be a lot to talk about in the next several months. We're going to break now, but when we come back, we'll have Craig Holman from Public Citizen to talk about corruption in government and the fight to stop it. Welcome back to the second half hour of Deadline DC with Brad Bannon. My company, Bannon Communications Research, pulls for and designs research-based media and message strategies for progressive issue groups, labor unions, and Democratic candidates. My company is the sponsor of today's show. If you want to learn more about me and my political polling and consulting company, check out my website at www.banoncr.com. Our guest in this half hour is Craig Holman, government affairs lobbyist for Public Citizen. Public Citizen was instrumental in the passage of the sweeping ethics and government legislation, H.R. 1, that recently passed the United States House of Representatives and is awaiting action, hopefully, in the United States Senate. Hi, Craig. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Brad. Thanks for inviting me on the show.
Well, it's an important issue, and I don't think it's probably got enough attention, so I'm glad to have you on. First of all, why don't you just start and explain to our listeners what H.R. 1 is. It's also called For the People Act. Just explain to us what's in it, because I think there's a lot in there.
There is a tremendous amount of material in H.R. 1. It is legislation that is 622 pages long. It basically has three main pillars, and each of these pillars are designed to basically what the congressional Democrats have done is they've just taken a look at everything wrong with the Trump administration and have developed a massive response in H.R. 1. The first pillar deals with voting rights, makes it easier for voters to participate in our elections. The second pillar deals with campaign finance reform, providing a small donor public matching fund program for both congressional and presidential elections. And the third pillar deals with ethics, making sure things like the revolving door are clamped down and that the conflict of interest code applies to the White House and particularly the president. So this is one massive bill. And I want to emphasize how exciting it is. You know, as opposed to the past 2 years here, things have gotten really interesting on Capitol Hill. Now the Democrats are basically have identified what the major problems are, and they are almost unanimous in these solutions. As a matter of fact, in the House, every single House Democrat co-sponsored the bill and voted for it. And now it's going to be introduced in the Senate next week. And so far, we're only short 8 Democrats signing on to it. So that's what I'm working on this week, is trying to get those 8 on board.
Well, good. It's God's work, Craig. We've already got a couple of callers on the line who want to talk to you. First, we're going to go to our good friend Michael from the Bronx on line 3. Michael?
Hey, Brad. How you doing?
I'm doing fine, Michael. How are you doing?
Oh, we're hanging in there. Here's the thing about the HR resolution, that the way I see it, where should I start with? I look at what's happened in New Zealand, for one thing. The racism and the hate that's going on, and it's been going on since Trump's campaign, fast forward to Charlottesville, and he's forever defending those white nationalists and encouraging them to commit crime and terrorism. And these Republicans that are just constantly defending Trump, in my view, that's aiding and abetting a criminal. And then we look at also what happened with the university, the college scandal. Here's these people, they're cheating their way through, and they're the same rats that got to say, well, you want to get in, you got to earn, you got to work hard for it. They don't follow their own advice, and those that do work hard are constantly screwed and cheated out. How is that making America great again?
Well, you know, Michael, I think you got a good point. When I saw this news about the college scandals last week, I thought to myself, you know, this is part of a larger problem about corruption in American society. And also about corruption in politics. Many Americans, I think most Americans, just doesn't think the system works. So, Craig, let me ask you, what specifically, what do you think the most important part of H.R. 1 is that will address this, the feeling that most Americans have that people in Washington are playing games and they have... And people out there have no opportunity at all to participate or influence the way the system works.
Well, I hate to play favorites with picking apart this massive bill because it all is so important. But if I had to identify probably the single most important reform being offered by H.R. 1, that would be public financing. That's, you know, it sets up a small donor public financing system, both for congressional and presidential races, where tax dollars, public funds, are matched 6 to every 1 contribution from a private source of $200 or less. That means, you know, if we get this implemented, we are going to make average Americans the center of our whole electoral system. You know, so suddenly this rule by the wealthy that we see under the Trump administration will basically start going away. I want to add, too, the Democrats came up with a very clever financing system for the public financing program. They would level a fine on civil penalties. So essentially, this program would make criminals pay for politicians, which I just kind of get a kick out of.
Yeah, you know, I mean, one of the things I saw, I guess it was today, that Ted Cruz borrowed or something $500,000 from his wife's firm, Goldman Sachs, to run his first Senate campaign. And I guess it was today the Federal Elections Commission announced that he was paying a $35,000 fine for not reporting $500,000. And I think that's the kind of thing that really drives Americans crazy about the campaign finance system.
Yes, indeed, Brad. As a matter of fact, you know, one of the other reforms that H.R. 1 offers is restructuring the Federal Election Commission. We really have an agency that very, very rarely enforces the campaign finance law. This is just one glaring example that I think the FEC just simply couldn't ignore. However, when it comes to usual enforcement, we don't have much. Usually, the commission deadlocks on a partisan line, and that means nothing gets done. So H.R. 1 would also restructure the Federal Election Commission and turn it into an actual campaign finance cop.
Okay. Craig, we've got another caller on the line for you. It's our good friend Reggie from Georgia on line 2. Reggie, how you doing today?
Happy Monday to you, Brad. Long time no hear or see from you, man. I would like
good
to know
hear
why
from you again.
Okay, well, I don't know why. I just want to know one thing. Why is it taking these Republicans so damn long to try to beat Donald Trump? Are they afraid of him? Are they scared of him? Does he have control, hold of power over them? And why are the Republicans bitching now that the Democrats are trying to do the exact same thing that they should have done over 2 years ago but never did? You know, they sat on their ass and could have been done and did virtually 210% nothing.
Craig, do you want to respond to Reggie?
Sure, I'll try responding. I mean, Donald Trump has really unified House and Senate Democrats in a comprehensive campaign finance, ethics, and voting rights program. You know, Trump was elected in part on drain the swamp. It was a campaign phrase that he really didn't believe in. He once actually gave a speech in Iowa about it, in Las Vegas, where he was saying, you know, I uttered drain the swamp and the crowd went crazy, you know, and I uttered it again, the crowd just went crazy. Isn't that just amazing? So I guess drain the swamp. So that became his campaign slogan, and he never really believed in it. And we now see that very clearly when Trump took over the administration. He is the most scandal-ridden administration we've seen in recent history, and it goes from the top down. You know, so that has really unified the Democrats behind this H.R. 1. And I'll tell you, you know, one thing, the most important thing H.R. 1 is going to do is when we get into the 2020 elections, it provides a very clear line of demarcation for voters as to what the Democrats stand for as opposed to what the Republicans stand for. I want to emphasize, in the House, every single Democrat backed this bill and every single Republican opposed it. And I'm expecting to see the same trend in the Senate.
Okay. Craig, we're going to go to break now, but when we back, we'll have more of Craig Holman from Public Citizen and Deadline DC with Brad Bannon. This is Brad Bannon back with more of Deadline DC with Brad Bannon. Our guest in this half hour is Craig Holman, who is the government affairs lobbyist for Public Citizens. And we're talking about the For the People Act, which recently passed the U.S. House of Representatives and is facing action in the United States Senate. Now, Craig, my guess is I haven't talked to Mitch lately, but my guess is that this kind of proposal probably is not high on Mitch McConnell's to-do list. How do you deal with that?
Well, Mitch McConnell has repeatedly said he's not going to allow a hearing or a vote on H.R. 1. And quite frankly, he has the authority to prevent that as majority leader. However, that is going to backfire. Mitch McConnell, if he does that, if he obstructs any consideration of H.R. 1 and any vote on H.R. 1, he is going to just play along right into the hands of the Democrats, casting the Republicans and the Republican leadership as opposed to voting rights, opposed to campaign finance reform, and opposed to ethics. As a matter of fact, Mitch McConnell, when we talk about voting rights, I mean, you know, that pillar would make it just so much easier for all Americans to vote and participate in our elections. And when Mitch saw that, he called it a power grab. Can you imagine calling a power grab against Americans who want to participate in our elections? You know, this is going to backfire on Mitch McConnell.
Well, I hope you're right. Let me ask you two questions in the few minutes we have left, Craig. First of all, we have Arbitron says we have about 600,000 people who listen to the show every month, and I imagine at least some of them are concerned about the lack of ethics in government and the breadth, width, and breadth of corruption. What can you say, what can our listeners who are interested in this, what can they do?
I want the listeners to call their senators to make sure we get every single Democratic senator on board and encourage Republicans to join in, but yeah, they're not going to. But boy, it would be perfect if we can get every Democrat in the House and every Democrat in the Senate co-sponsoring this legislation and staking out ethics as the main issue that's going to separate the parties as we go into the 2020 elections. That is big. I do want to emphasize the importance of the ethics section. I mean, we've got a president now who has just refused to participate or even respect the conflict of interest code. Every president prior to Trump has honored the conflict of interest code. You know, Jimmy Carter even sold his peanut farm in order to be in compliance with the conflict of interest code. We have a president today who actually goes out there and declares as president he can't have a conflict of interest. So this H.R. 1 would make it very clear that the conflict of interest code applies to the president and the vice president, the entire White House, and it would strengthen the Ethics Enforcement Agency, the Office of Government Ethics, and make it the actual ethics cop to enforce this. You know, I can go through every bit of H.R. 1, and I think if your listeners would want to check it out, they can find it online, and it will impress.
Yeah, I imagine it will. Let me ask you another question about the Senate. Are any of the Republicans, like maybe Susan Collins or of Maine or Lisa Murkowski, of Alaska, if they expressed any interest in the House bill as it was passed?
And not yet. There may be a couple moderate Republicans who would be willing to sign on, but judging from what the vote we saw in the House, I consider it unlikely. I mean, Mitch McConnell is going to make it very clear that if any Republicans did want to co-sponsor H.R. 1 or vote for it, that he would consider them betraying the Republican Party. So I suspect it's unlikely, but I'm not giving up hope. I mean, if any Republican wants to sign on, please do.
You know, you brought up something earlier in the half hour that I wanted to revisit. It seems to me that this whole concept of Donald Trump, talking about in his 2016 draining the swamp, from my observation, I think that was a very important part of the success he had in 2016, because Americans really thought the swamp in D.C. was pretty fetid, and they wanted someone to do something about it. And I don't think they saw that in Hillary Clinton, since she had spent a couple of decades in the swamp herself. But, you know, I think if one of the Democratic candidates can make a case, because my opinion is I think voters are as angry or even more angry about things in D.C. than they were in 2016. And I think they really that's one of the failures they see in the Trump administration. I saw this morning that Trump's job rating in the Gallup poll was down to 39%, which is way lower than the average of his press predecessors. And it looks to me that one of the reasons is that he didn't deliver on his promise to drain the swamp. And I think there's an opportunity out there for a Democratic presidential candidate to hop on there and do something about it. Let me ask you this question. Do you think any of the Democratic presidential candidates are addressing this concern about corruption in government and in the Trump administration effectively?
They will be once H.R. 1, really materializes in the Senate. This H.R. 1 is going to set the standard for the Democratic Party. So I would fully expect all the Democratic presidential candidates to get on board. Everyone sees how important this is. I mean, Trump didn't just fail to deliver on draining the swamp. He has made the swamp worse. We've never seen 8 convictions before in the first 2 years of an administration, 32 criminal indictments. More than 40 high-profile people in the administration have been forced to leave or voluntarily fled. Scott Pruitt, Ryan Zinke, Paul Manafort, Michael Cohen, just go through the list of Trump swamp, and you can see why it's so important that H.R. 1 stake out a true ethics program.
Okay, Craig, that's all the time we have today for Deadline DC with Brad Bannon. Thanks for joining us on the show, and good luck on the For the People Act. We desperately need it. That's it for Deadline DC with Brad Bannon today. I'll be back next Monday, if the Lord is willing, the creek don't rise, and Donald Trump doesn't declare martial law. Thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you next week.